Public Works Steampunk presents Jane Eyre, written by Charlotte Bronte, with steampunk additions by R.A. Harding. Read by Danita Feldman.
Chapter 5, in which Jane embarks on a journey. 5 o'clock had hardly struck on the morning of the 19th of May, when Bessie brought a candle into my closet and found me already up and nearly dressed. I had risen half an hour before her entrance and had washed my face, repinned my hair away from my temples, applied a few drops of oil to my ocular gears, and put on my clothes by the light of a half moon just setting, whose rays streamed through the narrow window near my crib. I was to leave Gateshead that day by a coach which passed the lodge gates at 6 a.m. and that evening be transferred to the care of an airship that would take me the rest of the way to India. Bessie was the only person yet risen. She had lit a fire in the nursery, where she now proceeded to make my breakfast. Few children can eat when excited with the thoughts of a journey, nor could I. Bessie, having pressed me in vain to take a few spoonfuls of the boiled milk and bread she had prepared for me, wrapped up some biscuits in a paper and put them into my bag. Then she helped me on with my pelisse and bonnet, which was designed to cover the gears to keep them warm but not hinder their movement. And wrapping herself in a shawl, she and I left the nursery. As we passed Mrs. Reed's bedroom, she said, "Will you go in and bid Mrs. goodbye?" "No, Bessie. She came to my crib late last night when you were gone down to supper, and said I need not disturb her in the morning, or my cousins either. And she told me to remember that she had always been my best friend, and to speak of her and be grateful to her accordingly." "What did you say, miss?" "Nothing. I covered my face with the bedclothes and turned from her to the wall." "That was wrong, Miss Jane." "It was quite right, Bessie. Your missus has not been my friend. She has been my foe." "Oh, Miss Jane, don't say so." "Goodbye to Gateshead," cried I, as we passed through the hall and went out at the front door. The moon was set, and it was very dark. Bessie carried a lantern, whose light glanced on wet steps and gravel roads sodden by a recent rain. Chill was the morning. My teeth chattered as I hastened down the drive. There was a light in the porter's lodge. When we reached it, we found the porter's wife just kindling her fire. My trunk, which had been carried down the evening before, stood corded at the door. The manor had lowered itself to meet the edge of the road and was resting on its pylons. Without the engines thrumming to keep us aloft, the morning held a deep and solemn quiet. It wanted but a few minutes of 6, and shortly after that hour had struck, the distant roll of wheels announced the coming coach. I went to the door and watched its lamps approach rapidly through the gloom. "She going by herself?" asked the porter's wife. "Yes." "And how far is it?" 4,000 miles, a coach ride, a day and a half by dirigible, and then another carriage ride to the school." "What a long way. I wonder Mrs. Reed is not afraid to trust her so far alone." The coach drew up. There it was at the gates, with its 4 horses and its top laden with passengers. The guard and coachman loudly urged haste. My trunk was hoisted up. I was taken from Bessie's neck, to which I clung with kisses. "Be sure and take good care of her," cried she to the guard as he lifted me into the inside. "Aye, aye," was the answer. The door was slapped to. A voice exclaimed, "All right!" And on we drove. Thus was I severed from Bessie and Gateshead, thus whirled away to unknown, and as I then deemed, remote and mysterious regions. I remember but little of the first ride of the journey. I only know that the day seemed to me of a preternatural length, and that we appeared to travel over hundreds of miles of road as the sun rose and began to travel overhead, though the day was grey with cloud and fog. We passed through several towns, and in one, a very large one, the coach stopped, the horses were taken out, and the passengers alighted. It was here the coachman escorted me to a tall building, and after ensuring that my luggage would be transferred properly, walked with me up the many flights of steps to the gangplank leading to the dirigible. I had seen smaller airships come and go from Gateshead Manor, but this airship seemed even bigger than the manor house. The stretched canvas over ribs puffed in and out as the ship gently bobbed up and down beneath the balloon. The many ropes that held it tethered in place made it look like an enormous fly that had been caught by a spider. I took a tentative step onto the plank between the tower and the airship, and grasping the rope railings, I made my way across to a porter who welcomed me and showed me to the dining room. But as I had no appetite despite him trying to tempt me with sweetbread and milk, he showed me to my place in the passenger section and left me sitting on a hard wooden seat near a window. It was from this vantage point I could see through the mist some of the tops of the houses and make out the comings and goings of some of the townsfolk. They moved slowly, and with the glass between me and the events, it felt like I was looking at ghosts moving in an underworld. The thought of the underworld brought back the chilling moments in the Red Room, and I dared not look out the window again until I felt the engines begin to thrum, and the airship began to move. It was my first time flying, to my young memory. In such a wondrous machine and at that altitude, I once again turned towards the windows and glimpsed tops of buildings, stacked chimneys, church steeples and temple domes as we rose above the fog. I could see the city spread out before me in miniature and felt like Gulliver when he stood above the town of Lilliput. We soon passed through a second layer of clouds, and for a time the windows were a shimmering pearlescent. Some passengers exclaiming this must be what the gateway to heaven and the realms of the gods looked like. We ascended through that layer, and then it was the bright light of the sun over the white field of clouds that seemed to stretch forever. At times, a glimmer of the sea far below could be seen, but I soon grew tired of this, and lulled by the sound of the dirigible engines, I at last dropped to sleep. I was woken by a gloved hand on my shoulder and saw that the sun had set and the scene outside my window was naught but shadows and darkness. The porter was offering me a blanket, but seeing my sleep-heavy confusion, he tucked it round me and turned the gas lamps low in the passenger section. The deep thrumming of the propellers reminded me of the engines at Gateshead, and I soon again slept. The early light woke me, and I was blessed with the sight of the sun rising over the clouds, looking like great hills heaving up around the horizon. While my naked eye could only see and marvel at the light, the ticking and whirring of my mechanical eye showed me the intricate wonders of the sky, the curved shadow of the earth being swept away by the sun's great light, the birds' marvelous shifting colours as they swept across the rosy sky, a dazzling sight to my young mind. The day progressed steadily, and I had very little to do. I had not been allowed to take a book, so I entertained myself looking out the window, catching glimpses of the world below. The porters once or twice guided me to the privy and offered me food, but I was unable to eat more than a few bites. The day passed, and the evening darkness once again enclosed the balloon. I drifted asleep, and had not long slumbered when the sudden cessation of motion awoke me, and those around me began to gather their belongings and move to disembark. I was unsure what I was to do when the porter came to the passenger section. "Is there a little girl called Jane Eyre?" I nodded and was told to follow. The porter guided me through the corridors, out and across the gangplank, and a person like a servant was standing at it. I saw her face and dress by the light of the lamps. "Jane Eyre?" she asked. I answered yes, and walked across the plank to meet her. My trunk was handed across to a man who was also waiting with us. We descended some stairs, and I was put into a carriage just as the airship, which must have completed the change in passengers, started the great propellers and swept away. I was stiff with long sitting, and bewildered with the noise and motion of the airship receding into darkness. Gathering my faculties, I looked about me. Warm rain, wind, and darkness filled the air. Nevertheless, the carriage was dry and began moving at a quick pace for the space of about an hour, which seemed filled with new sounds and smells, though I could see little through the darkened windows. When the motion finally ceased, The woman encouraged me to step from the carriage and into the warm rain. I dimly discerned a wall before me and a door open in it. Through this door I passed with my new guide. She shut and locked it behind her. I could not see anything except what light was thrown by the lantern the woman held. There were stone steps and walls, a smell of damp as we made our way down to another door and out into the night. There was now visible a house or houses, for the building spread far. With many windows and lights burning in some, we went up a broad pebbly path, splashing wet, and were admitted at a door. Then the servant led me through a passage into a room with a fire, where she left me alone. I removed my cloak as it was damp and heavy, as well as the temperature being warmer than it had been at Gateshead. I stood and tried to dry my wet fingers over the blaze, then looked around. There was no candle or gas lamp, but the uncertain light from the hearth showed by intervals papered walls, carpet, curtains, shining mahogany furniture. It was a parlour, not so spacious or splendid as the drawing room at Gateshead, but comfortable enough. I was puzzling to make out the subject of a picture on the wall when the door opened and an individual carrying a light entered. Another followed close behind. The first was a tall lady with dark hair, dark eyes, dark skin, and large forehead. Her figure was partly enveloped in a shawl. Her countenance was grave, her bearing erect. "The child is very young to be sent alone," said she, putting her oil lamp down on the table. She considered me attentively for a minute or two, then further added, "She had better be put to bed soon. She looks tired." "Are you tired?" she asked, placing her hand on my shoulder. "A little, ma'am." "And hungry too, no doubt. Let her have some supper before she goes to bed, Miss Miller. Is this the first time you have left your parents to come to school?" I explained to her that I had no parents. She inquired how long they had been dead, then how old I was, what was my name, whether I could read, write, and sew a little. Then she touched my cheek gently with her forefinger, observed my ocular gears, and saying she hoped I should be a good child, dismissed me along with Miss Miller. The lady I had left might be about 29. The one who went with me appeared some years younger. The first impressed me by her voice, look, and air. Miss Miller was more ordinary, ruddy in complexion, though of a careworn countenance, hurried in gait and action, like one who had always a multiplicity of tasks on hand. She looked, indeed, what I afterwards found she really was, an under-teacher. Led by her, I passed from compartment to compartment, from passage to passage, of a large and irregular building, till, emerging from the total and somewhat dreary silence pervading that portion of the house we had traversed, we came upon the hum of many voices, and presently entered a wide, long room with great deal tables, two at each end, and on each of which burnt a pair of candles, and seated all round on benches a congregation of girls of every age from 9 or 10 to 20. Seen by the dim light of the dips, their number to me appeared countless, though not in reality exceeding 80. They were uniformly dressed in blue tunics over loose white pants and brown vests buttoned in the front, and some had long plain white scarves wrapped around their shoulders and hair that I would later come to know as a chunny. It was the hour of study. They were engaged in studying over their tomorrow's task, and the hum I had heard was the combined result of their whispered repetitions. Miss Miller signed to me to sit on a bench near the door. Then, walking up to the top of the long room, she cried out, "Monitors, collect the lesson books and put them away." 4 tall girls arose from different tables, and going around gathered the books and removed them. Miss Miller again gave the word of command. "Monitors, fetch the supper trays." The tall girls went out and returned presently, each bearing a tray with portions of something I knew not what arranged thereon, and a pitcher of water and mug in the middle of each tray. The portions were handed round. Those who liked took a draught of the water, the mug being common to all. When it came to my turn, I drank, for I was thirsty, but did not touch the food, excitement and fatigue rendering me incapable of eating. I now saw, however, that it was a thin chapati shared into fragments. The meal over, we filed into a shrine room and took our seats as candles and incense were lit. Prayers and chants were read by Miss Miller, and the classes filed off two and two upstairs. Overpowered by this time with weariness, I scarcely noticed what sort of a place the bedroom was, except that, like the schoolroom, I saw that it was very long. Tonight I was to be Miss Miller's bedfellow. She helped me to undress. When laid down, I glanced at the long rows of beds, each of which was quickly filled with two occupants. In 10 minutes, the single light was extinguished, and amidst silence and complete darkness, I fell asleep. The night passed rapidly. I was too tired even to dream. I only once awoke to hear the wind rave in furious gusts and the rain fall in torrents, and to be sensible that Miss Miller had taken her place by my side. When I again unclosed my eyes, a loud bell was ringing. The girls were up and dressing. Day had not yet begun to dawn, and a rushlight or two burned in the room. I too rose reluctantly, and washed when there was a basin at liberty, which did not occur soon, as there was but one basin to six girls on the stands down the middle of the room. Again the bell rang. All formed in file, two and two, and in that order descended the stairs and entered the humid and dimly lit schoolroom. Here prayers were read by Miss Miller. Afterwards she called out, "Form classes!" A great tumult succeeded for some minutes, during which Miss Miller repeatedly exclaimed, "Shanty! An order!" When it subsided, I saw them all drawn up in four semicircles before four chairs placed at four tables. All held books in their hands, and a great book lay on each table before the vacant seat. At either end of the room, large platforms were pulled in upon which a variety of large and small machinery were sitting. A pause of some seconds succeeded, filled up by the low, vague hum of numbers. Miss Miller walked from class to class, hushing this indefinite sound. A distant bell tinkled. Immediately three ladies entered the room. Each walked to a table and took her seat. Miss Miller assumed the fourth vacant chair, which was that nearest the door, and around which the smallest of the children were assembled. To this inferior class I was called and placed at the bottom of it. Business now began. The day's mantra was repeated and the holy lamp was lit. Then certain texts of scripture were said, and to these succeeded a protracted reading of chapters in the Vedas, which lasted an hour. By the time that exercise was terminated, day had fully dawned. The indefatigable bell now sounded for the fourth time. The classes were marshalled and marched into another room to breakfast. How glad I was to behold a prospect of getting something to eat. I was now nearly sick from hunger, having taken so little the day before. The refectory was a great low-ceilinged, gloomy room. On two long tables smoked basins of something hot, which, however, to my dismay, sent forth an odour far from inviting. I saw a universal manifestation of discontent when the smell of the food met the nostrils of those destined to swallow it. From the van of the procession, the tall girls of the first class rose the whispered words, "Disgusting, the porridge is burnt again." "Silence!" called out a voice, not that of Miss Miller, but one of the upper teachers, a little and dark personage, smartly dressed, but of somewhat morose aspect, who installed herself at the top of one table, while a more buxom lady presided at the other. I looked in vain for her I had first seen the night before. She was not visible. Miss Miller occupied the foot of the table where I sat, and a strange, foreign-looking elderly lady, the language teacher, as I afterwards found, took the corresponding seat at the other board. A long grace was said and a hymn sung. Then a servant brought in some tea for the teachers, and the meal began. Ravenous and now very faint, I devoured a spoonful or two of my portion without thinking of its taste. But the first edge of hunger blunted, I perceived I had got in hand a nauseous mess. Burnt porridge is almost as bad as rotten potatoes, Famine itself soon sickens over it. The spoons were moved slowly. I saw each girl taste her food and try to swallow it, but in most cases the effort was soon relinquished. Breakfast was over, and none had breakfasted. Thanks being returned for what we had not got, and a second hymn chanted, the refectory was evacuated for the schoolroom. I was one of the last to go out, and in passing the tables, I saw one teacher take a basin of the porridge and taste it. She looked at the others. All their countenances expressed displeasure, and one of them, the stout one, whispered, "Abominable stuff! How shameful!" A quarter of an hour passed before lessons again began, during which the schoolroom was in a glorious tumult. For that space of time it seemed to be permitted to talk loud and more freely, and they used their privilege. The whole conversation ran on the breakfast, which one and all abused roundly. Poor things, it was the sole consolation they had. Miss Miller was now the only teacher in the room. A group of great girls standing about her spoke with serious and sullen gestures. I heard the name of Mr. Brocklehurst pronounced by some lips, at which Miss Miller shook her head disapprovingly, but she made no great effort to check the general wrath. Doubtless she shared in it. It was during this time I finally had a moment to observe the girls that attended this school. I had expected and found a variety of ages and colours. My great surprise arising when I saw a number of my new classmates also fitted with clockwork additions. I observed a classmate with a seeming mechanical glove that replaced specific digits on her hand. Another student stood on one leg that seemed flesh, and the other shone with burnished copper. I observed her discreetly wind some spring at her knee with a key that was attached to her wrist with a cord. Other girls also had clockwork eyes of varying intricacies, but I observed that none were as delicate as mine. Many ocular orbs were held upon the face with leather strapping that crossed their heads. It struck me how expensive my mechanisms must have been, and I resolved to say a prayer for my uncle when next I chanted. A clock in the schoolroom struck nine. Miss Miller left her circle, and standing in the middle of the room cried, "Silence! To your seats!" Discipline prevailed. In 5 minutes the confused throng was resolved into order, and comparative silence quelled the babble clamour of tongues. The upper teachers now punctually resumed their posts, but still all seemed to wait. Ranged on benches down the sides of the room, the 80 girls sat motionless and erect. A quaint assemblage they appeared, all with plain locks combed from their faces, not a curl visible, in salwar kameez, blue tunics over loose white pants and brown vests buttoned in front with deep work pockets, where each carried pencils, and various delicate tools could be seen poking up, all too wearing simple woven sandals. Above 20 of those clad in this costume were full-grown girls, or rather young women. It suited them ill, and gave an air of oddity even to the prettiest. I was still looking at them, and also at intervals examining the teachers, none of whom precisely pleased me, for the stout one was a little coarse, the dark one not a little fierce, the foreigner harsh, and Miss Miller, poor thing, looked purple, weather-beaten, and overworked. When, as my eye wandered from face to face, the whole school rose simultaneously as if moved by a common spring. What was the matter? I had heard no order given. I was puzzled. Ere I had gathered my wits, the classes were again seated, but as all eyes were now turned to one point, mine followed the general direction, and encountered the personage who had received me last night. She stood at the bottom of the long room on the hearth, for there was a fire at each end. She surveyed the two rows of girls silently and gravely. Miss Miller, approaching, seemed to ask her a question, and having received her answer, went back to her place and said aloud, "Monitor of the first class, fetch the globes." While the direction was being executed, the lady consulted moved slowly up the room. I suppose I have a considerable organ of veneration, for I retain yet the sense of admiring awe with which my eyes traced her steps. Seen now in broad daylight, she looked tall and shapely, brown eyes with a kind gaze and a fine pencilling of long lashes round. On each of her temples, her hair, of a very dark black, was clustered in round curls according to the fashion of those times, when neither smooth bands nor long ringlets were in vogue. Her salwar kameez, also in the mode of the day, was of purple cloth. A gold watch shone at her waistcoat. Let the reader add, to complete the picture, refined features, a clear complexion, and a stately air and carriage. And he will have, at least as clearly as words can give it, a correct idea of the exterior of Miss Mandeer, Deva Mandeer, as I afterwards saw the name written in a prayer book entrusted to me. The superintendent of Lowood, for such was this lady, having taken her seat before a pair of globes placed on one of the tables, summoned the first class round her, and commenced giving a lesson on geography. The lower classes were called by the teachers. Repetitions in history, grammar, and language went on for an hour. Writing and arithmetic succeeded. A few were gathered to be instructed in mechanics resting on the long platforms, and music lessons were given by Miss Mandeer to some of the elder girls. The duration of each lesson was measured by the clock, which at last struck 12. The superintendent rose. "I have a word to address to the pupils," said she. The tumult of cessation from lessons was already breaking forth, but it sank at her voice. She went on, "You had this morning a breakfast which you could not eat. You must be hungry. I have ordered that a lunch of roti and cheese shall be served to all." The teachers looked at her with a sort of surprise. "It is to be done on my responsibility," she added, in an explanatory tone to them, and immediately afterwards left the room. The roti and cheese was presently brought in and distributed to the high delight and refreshment of the school. The order was now given to the garden, and following the stream I made my way into the open air. The garden was a wide enclosure, surrounded with walls so high as to exclude every glimpse of prospect. A covered veranda ran down one side, and broad walks bordered a middle space divided into scores of little beds. These beds were assigned as gardens for the pupils to cultivate, and each bed had an owner. They were full of flowers and looked quite pretty, but I could not recognize any of the species, as I had never seen them before. I stood and looked round me. It was an inclement day for outdoor exercise, not positively rainy, but darkened by a drizzling fog. All underfoot was still soaking wet with the floods of yesterday. The stronger among the girls ran about and engaged in active games, but sundry pale and thin ones herded together for shelter in the veranda. And amongst these, as the dense mist penetrated to their frames, I heard frequently the sound of a hollow cough. As yet, I had spoken to no one, nor did anybody seem to take notice of me. I stood lonely enough, but to that feeling of isolation I was accustomed, it did not oppress me much. I leant against a pillar of the veranda, drew my arms close about me, and trying to forget the wet that clung to me without, and the unsatisfied hunger which gnawed me within, delivered myself up to the employment of watching and thinking. My reflections were too undefined and fragmentary to merit record. I hardly yet knew where I was. Gateshead and my past life seemed floated away to an immeasurable distance. The present was vague and strange, and of the future I could form no conjecture. Under my feet I felt no familiar rumble of steam engine which made me feel the change of scenery more deeply. I looked round the convent-like garden and then up at the house. A large building, half of which seemed grey and old, the other half quite new. The new part, containing the schoolroom and dormitory, was lit by mullioned and latticed windows, which gave it a church-like aspect. A stone tablet over the door bore this inscription, "Lowood Institution." This portion was rebuilt A.D. by Naomi Brocklehurst of Brocklehurst Hall, in this county. "Let your light so shine before men that they may see your good works and glorify your Father which is in heaven." St. Matthew, verse 16. "Through selfless service you will always be fruitful and find the fulfillment of your desires. Bhagavad Gita. I read these words over and over again. I felt that an explanation belonged to them and was unable fully to penetrate their import. I was still pondering the signification of institution and endeavouring to make out a connection between the first words and the verses of scripture, when the sound of a cough close behind me made me turn my head. I saw a girl sitting on a stone bench near. She was bent over a book, on the perusal of which she seemed intent. From where I stood, I could see the title. It was Rasalas, a name that struck me as strange and consequently attractive. In turning a leaf, she happened to look up, and I said to her directly, "Is your book interesting?" I had already formed the intention of asking her to lend it to me some day. "I like it," she answered after a pause of a second or two, during which she examined me. "What is it about?" I continued. I hardly know where I found the hardihood thus to open a conversation with a stranger. The step was contrary to my nature and habits, but I think her occupation touched a chord of sympathy somewhere, for I too liked reading, though of a frivolous and childish kind. I could not digest or comprehend the serious or substantial.
"You may look at it," replied the girl, offering me the book. I did so. A brief examination convinced me that the contents were less taking than the title. Rasselas looked dull to my trifling taste. I saw nothing about fairies, nothing about genie, no bright variety seemed to spread over the closely printed pages. I returned it to her.
She received it quietly, and without saying anything, she was about to relapse into her former studious mood. Again, I ventured to disturb her.
"Can you tell me what the writing on that stone over the door means? What is Lowood Institution? This house where you have come to live? And why do they call it an institution? Is it in any way different from other schools?"
"It's partly a charity school. You and I and all the rest of us are charity children. I suppose you are an orphan. Are not either your father or your mother dead?"
"Both died before I can remember."
"Well, all the girls here have lost either one or both parents, and this is called an institution for educating orphans."
"Do we pay no money? Do they keep us for nothing?"
"We pay, or our friends pay, £15 a year for each."
"Then why do they call us charity children?"
"Because £15 is not enough for board and teaching, and the deficiency is supplied by subscription."
"Who subscribes?"
"Different benevolent-minded ladies and gentlemen."
"Who is Naomi Brocklehurst?"
"The lady who built the new part of this house, as that tablet records, and whose son overlooks and directs everything here."
"Why?"
"Because he is treasurer and manager of the establishment."
"Then this house does not belong to that tall lady who wears a watch and who said we were to have some roti and cheese?"
"To Miss Mandeer? Oh no, I wish it did. She has to answer to Mr. Brocklehurst for all she does. Mr. Brocklehurst buys all our food and all our clothes."
"Does he live here?"
"No, 2 miles off at a large hall."
"Is he a good man?"
"He is a clergy pundit and is said to do a great deal of good."
"Did you say that tall lady was called Miss Mandeer?"
"Yes."
"And what are the other teachers called?"
"The one with the red cheeks is called Miss Smith. She attends to the work and cutouts, for we make our own clothes, our underclothes, our vests and everything, as well as teaching mechanics. The little one with the black hair is Miss Scatcherd. She teaches history and grammar, and hears the second-class repetitions. And the one who wears the shawl and has a pocket handkerchief tied to her side with a yellow ribbon is Madame Pierrot. She comes from Lille in France and teaches French."
"Do you like the teachers?"
"Well enough."
Do you like the Madame... I cannot pronounce her name as you do."
"Miss Scatcherd is hasty. You must take care not to offend her. Madame Pierrot is not a bad sort of person."
"But Miss Mandeer is the best, isn't she?"
"Miss Mandeer is very good and very clever. She is above the rest because she knows far more than they do."
"Have you been long here?"
2 years."
"Are you an orphan?"
"My mother is dead."
"Are you happy here?"
"You ask rather too many questions. I have given you answers enough for the present. Now I want to read." But at that moment the summons sounded for dinner. All re-entered the house. The odour which now filled the refectory was scarcely more appetising than that which had regaled our nostrils at breakfast. The dinner was served in two huge tin-plated vessels, whence rose a strong stream redolent of rancid fat. I found the mess to consist of indifferent potatoes and strange shreds of rusty meat, mixed and cooked together. Of this preparation, a tolerably abundant plateful was apportioned to each pupil. I ate what I could, and wondered within myself whether every day's fare would be like this. After dinner, we immediately adjourned to the schoolroom. Lessons recommenced and were continued till 5 o'clock. The only marked event of the afternoon was that I saw the girl with whom I had conversed in the veranda dismissed in disgrace by Miss Scatcherd from a history class and said to stand in the middle of the large schoolroom. The punishment seemed to me in a high degree ignominious, especially for so great a girl. She looked 13 or upwards. I expected she would show signs of great distress and shame, but to my surprise she neither wept nor blushed. Composed, though grave, she stood the central mark of all eyes. How can she bear it so quietly, so firmly, I asked of myself. Were I in her place, it seems to me I should wish the earth to open and swallow me up. She looks as if she were thinking of something beyond her punishment, beyond her situation, of something not round her nor before her. I have heard of daydreams. Is she in a daydream now? Her eyes are fixed on the floor, but I am sure they do not see it. Her sight seems turned in, gone down into her heart. She is looking at what she can remember, I believe, not at what is really present. I wonder what sort of girl she is, whether good or naughty. Soon after 5 p.m., we had another meal, consisting of a small mug of chai and half a slice of brown bread. I devoured my bread and drank my chai with relish, but I should have been glad of as much more. I was still hungry. Half an hour's recreation succeeded, then study, then the glass of water and the piece of roti, prayers and bed. Such was my first day at Lowood.
Thank you for listening to this chapter of Public Works Steampunk Presents Jane Eyre. This book is copyright 2021 by R. A. Harding. If you enjoy this podcast, please leave a review. The music box intro and outro was recorded by Nicholas Drewski. If you would like to read the author's notes on the chapter or order the book, please go to publicworkssteampunk.com. And while you're there, join the mailing list to get a one-of-a-kind infographic about the book and more. Farewell for the present.